That's brilliant. Thank you, Hang. Thank you, Sam, for reading. Let me add my welcome, Sam. It's great to see you. It's quite a squeeze in here, but it's nice, isn't it, to have such a crowd. Sam was just reminding me that this was the building in which we began as Grace Church Greenwich 7 years ago, and we were a much tinier number than this, and especially in August, you know, there's about five of us, and we thought, you know, is there anyone in this church? Because everyone was away on holiday. So it's really exciting to have a crowd, even in August, and welcome. I hope it's not too warm at the back. It's not quite as bad as it was last week. But if you are melting, then come forward and sit near a fan, because it's quite a lot cooler there. Well, Michaela's very strategically positioned herself. So that is the coolest place in the building if you need it. It's too hot. Let me add my welcome to Hangs. And also, let me underline that notice. Probably you hear a weekend away notice for October and think, I don't need to act on that yet. And probably you don't need to. But as Hang said, this is a fantastic opportunity. Most of the church goes away usually, so we don't have a Sunday service, and the majority of people come. And if you're new, it'd just be a fantastic way of getting to know you. I've seen there's a lot of new faces here that I don't recognize. And if it's your first week, then special welcome. But if you've been coming just 1 week or 2 or 3 weeks and you want to start to get to know people properly, then there's nothing like going away together. So consider that, and why not book it? It really helps our planning if people book early, and people never do. So maybe this could be the exception where you think, I will act now on that. Anyway, we're in Amos, and it's quite a frightening service, isn't it, already? I think, just as I was sitting in the pew, I thought it's quite unsettling to think about Judgment Day. Even the little illustration for the children, yeah, it's quite fun, wasn't it? James in his apron and, you know, sieving flour. And then as he throws the stones into the bucket and warns us that this is the future for those who do not trust in Jesus. That's kind of stark for a children's talk. It's kind of heavy. And then we were saying together those words of Jesus's, the famous parable of the sheep and the goats. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, he'll separate people as a man, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he says to some, away to everlasting destruction. But to the others, he says, welcome to everlasting life. It's kind of stark. We know the words probably, and they're famous words of Jesus, but even as we're saying them, you think this is heavy, all this talk of Judgment Day. Of course, if you've been in Grace Church Greenwich for the last few weeks, you're kind of getting used to it, because this is very much Amos's vibe, isn't it? I mean, he's not the smiliest kind of guy. He's the prophet of doom, and we've had 9 chapters of it, basically. Do come back next week, by the way, because there is a happy ending. And I know you might think that is inconceivable for Amos, that he could be upbeat, but he really is. The second half of the last chapter of Amos is kind of upbeat, but until now it's been sort of sustained doom. We say that Grace Church Greenwich is a church for skeptics, for inquirers and believers, and I don't want to make any assumptions about which of those three you are. Whoever you are, you're super welcome. And you might be here and you're a skeptic. You think, I don't know if I believe in this. I'm not a follower of Jesus. And coming to a service where in the children's talk, I'm likened to some stones that are chucked away. And having to say myself about people who are sent off to everlasting destruction, that's kind of heavy, to be honest. You know, it seems kind of extreme, doesn't it? Maybe Amos seems kind of extreme. This Old Testament fire and brimstone prophet. Actually, he hasn't mentioned brimstone, but he did mention fire 2 weeks ago. All of this talk of judgment. And it might be that it just sounds a bit shrill to you, a bit over the top. I put on the handout, you might want to follow along. This is where we're going on the inside of the service sheet. I put here, I just searched for on Google Images, the end of the world is nigh, because I thought, in my mind, this is associated with a crazy Christian with a banner. And indeed it is. I mean, you look at Google Images and there's a lot of them. And all the way back in times, there's black and white photos of people in sort of post-war dress holding placards saying the end of the world is nigh. This is my favorite one because it got a bit more specific about it, as you can see from the photograph. Judgment Day, May the 21st, 2011. Well, obviously it wasn't, was it? Because, you know, that's more than a decade ago. and the world did not end. And the guy who was behind this prediction was a guy called Harold Camping, and he was a broadcaster on Family Radio. You can see their website at the bottom of the page. And he predicted that fire and brimstone would fall on May the 21st, 2011, I think at 6 p.m. So he was quite specific. And then he worked out those different time zones. So he said it will start in one time zone and then kind of follow around the world. And obviously it didn't. And there was incredible mockery in the papers. And I found this photograph very easily because it was in all the international media, because he'd been so public about his prediction of doom, and then it didn't happen. And there was headlines like "The Day That the World Did Not End." And then, you know, there's a story of one Australian guy meeting a dejected Christian who'd expected, was sure that the world was going to end. And they put their arm around them and said, "Don't worry, mate, it's not the end of the world." Is these doomsday predictions just the, is it just the preserve of the lunatic religious fanatic? And you know, I guess with predictions like Harold Camping, you think maybe it is. But I've had a little bit of interest recently over the last couple of years on end of the world predictions, because it used to be the fact that it was always a crazy Christian or a crazy religious person who was predicting the end of the world. But I've discovered, and increasingly in the media, that actually quite a lot of people think the world's going to end. And the scenarios vary. But it's not only Christians who are announcing some sort of doomsday for the future. In fact, you can find all sorts of them. I think a couple of years ago, when I started this quest, there was one Wikipedia page devoted to doomsday scenarios. And now you go to the Wikipedia page for doomsday scenarios, and it's just an index for all the sub-pages for different categories of doomsday scenarios. I just thought I'd give you some of my favorite ones. Nuclear Holocaust. Not the end of the planet, but the end of human life, pretty much. The end of Western civilization. And people were very scared about this back in the Cold War. And in 1982, someone calculated that if there was a US-Soviet exchange, as they call it, i.e. both people pressed their buttons at the same time, about 450 million people could be wiped out. And, you know, that, I guess, in my childhood, that was the sort of thing people worried about. And you remember there was the national broadcast about what to do if there was a nuclear missile coming. And it's totally pointless, because basically you're going to be vaporized, especially if you live in London. I mean, you know, you're inside the blast radius, so there's no time to. But they were these sort of pointless bits of advice, like lean a door against your wall and shelter under it. Like, that's going to do any good at all. But anyway, people, that was the thing that people genuinely worried about in the 1980s and a little bit more recently. I mean, Putin does seem almost mad. He's got a button that does that. It doesn't seem entirely certain that he wouldn't press it. So I've been thinking that isn't impossible, and some people are quite worried about that. The Extinction Rebellion thing, you know, what if it's actually too late? And 40 degrees, what was it, 40.3 degrees in London becomes 45 degrees, becomes 50 degrees, becomes people literally melt. The current energy crisis becomes there's no energy left for the whole world. You know, you can imagine those kind of apocalyptic scenarios. One of the ones that the scientists are most worried about is asteroids hitting the Earth. Apparently, a 1 kilometer wide asteroid. So we're not talking a little meteor, a little rock in your garden. We're talking, you know, something a kilometer wide. So imagine that coming through the sky. That's due to hit the world on average every 500,000 years. And, you know, I think we're about due, basically. So one scientist writes, it's 100% certain we will be hit by a devastating asteroid. We're just not 100% sure when. Well, that's comforting. So, and then, you know, add pandemics, which have become a little bit more frightening recently. And then if you want to go to the ultra physicist answer, then you have the heat death of the universe, where the whole universe runs out of energy and reaches absolute 0 degrees Kelvin. So there we are. But actually, sort of everybody thinks that the human race is precarious. Every physicist thinks that eventually the Earth is not around forever. I mean, apparently in a billion years' time, the sun gets a little bit brighter and it vaporizes the oceans. So, you know, you're not going to survive that. So this is universal, actually. But Christians have a particular belief about the end of the world. And it actually doesn't end with a megalomaniac pressing a nuclear button, although there might be nuclear wars. It doesn't end with us running out of global energy, although there could be difficult times ahead in that regard. It doesn't end with the universe running out of energy. It ends with God calling time and bringing judgment. And Amos has been warning about this now for 9 chapters, and we come to the end of the book, and it is going to come. And God's judgment does come. Amos, it turns out, in history, wasn't bluffing. It's true. It really happened. And I put point one, some of the ways in which it does happen. God had warned of an earthquake. In fact, Amos began in Amos chapter 1. If you want to turn to it in your Bible, Amos chapter 1, verse 1. I haven't put that on the handout, but you can see it in your actual Bible. On page, if you close the Bible, it's on page 764. The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoah, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, the days of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Now, obviously, the prophecy of Amos is written with hindsight, so after the earthquake. But when Amos starts speaking, there's a kind of countdown to this massive earthquake. And it's actually reported elsewhere in ancient scriptures. In Zechariah refers to the great earthquake in the days of Uzziah. Earthquakes aren't particularly uncommon, by the way, in Israel. It's in a sort of geoactive part of the world. But a big earthquake came. And I guess you might say, oh, how primitive of them, blessed them, those ancient peoples, that when there was an earthquake, they thought it was God because they didn't understand geology. We're so dismissive. Nonetheless, I think a major earthquake probably does make most people think about God. You think about the fragility of human existence as literally the whole thing is shaken. And Amos is very clear, it is God who does the shaking. There is a physical earthquake. There's also a political earthquake. And the Assyrians really did come. At the time that Amos is predicting it, it just seems like an unnecessarily shrill, sort of scaremongering message, because Israel's doing really quite well at the time. I mean, their military is doing well. They've expanded the borders. They've beaten down their enemies. They've even conquered some neighboring territories. I mean, this is a day where Israel looks like one of the superpowers. And Amos says this country is going to come and exile them. Well, no one's even heard of Assyria at this stage. It's just this little nondescript country off the border. But it happens. Just a couple of generations later, it happens. I mean, 722 BC, the archaeologists can tell us the exact date the Assyrians come, and Israel is entirely obliterated as a country. And Judah is the little bit in the south that's left, but Israel up in the north is wiped out. It must have seemed so shrill, mustn't it, when Amos said in chapter 5, Gilgal shall surely go into exile. I don't think so, Amos. It looks pretty good to me. When he said in chapter 5, verse 27, I'll send you into exile beyond Damascus. What's beyond Damascus? What, beyond Syria? There's nothing over there. Well, yeah, the upcoming power of the Assyrians are going to be over there. In chapter 7, you might remember there was this standoff between Amos and the local archbishop, the priest Amaziah. And Amaziah thought it was absolutely scandalous that Amos had dared to prophesy the exile of this mighty nation. And Amaziah reports on it. Verse 11 of chapter 7, Amos says that the king's going to die and Israel's going to go into exile. And Amos says, yeah, that's right. That is what I say. What? You know, you're like Harold Camping. Yeah, with your little placards confidently predicting the end of the world, which is never going to come. By the way, I do think Harold Camping was a fake. Interestingly, he retired on October the 16th, 2011, just a couple of months after his end of the world prediction. But rather more chillingly, he retired worth $75 million. You know, there's money to be made by false prophecy. Imagine I said, the world's going to end next year. Only Grace Church Greenwich knows this. You must fund us now for our global message. And I pocket all the money. I mean, that's basically what was going on. So there are fake doomsday prophets, but Amos was a true one. Because it did happen, this political earthquake. An iconoclastic earthquake. I'm sorry about that phrase. I just couldn't resist putting that in a sermon outline. It wasn't a bet or anything, but I just thought, I never used the word iconoclastic before. Iconoclasm, this is basically the very controversial historical practice of smashing up fake religious things. And it is really quite controversial. So the Puritans did it. They didn't like some of the shrines and Mary shrines in cathedrals, all the Catholic stuff. So some of them smashed it up, the iconoclasts. And then famously the Islamic State did it, didn't they? They didn't like these beautiful sort of archaeological carvings of ancient civilizations. And so they blew them up with TNT. And you remember all the heritage people were up in arms about it, iconoclasm. And then it's a bit like what people are doing with statues. I don't know what you think about the statue debate. I know there's different views about it. But some people think let's just topple them or blow them up. I heard one solution in South Africa was I thought it was quite a good one actually, to move the statue into a museum because they no longer wanted to celebrate it. And I get that. You don't really want to celebrate the slave trader in the middle of your city where you have to live or the middle of your university. But you don't want to erase history either. So they just moved to a museum where they could explain. I thought that was quite a good solution. But some people want to smash them. And I don't know where you fall on those debates, but it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that God wants to smash them here. He doesn't think, oh, what beautiful religious art. These amazingly intricate golden calf statues that they've made. I mean, the best materials, at least gold-plated, if not made of actual gold. And this great shrine at Bethel, what an interesting bit of archaeology. And God says, Amos 9 verse 1, stands beside the altar of the false temple with the false worship and says, strike the capitals until the thresholds shake and shatter them on the heads of all the people. God shows up. Where does he go? He goes to church or to the fake church. He hates it. And he shakes it down. A physical earthquake, a political earthquake, an iconoclastic earthquake. And then a final earthquake still to come. And I've put a whole load of Bible references here because I basically want to show us that this is really central to the Bible's message. And everybody in the Bible thinks it. So I don't know how much the end of the world, the return of Jesus in person, to judge the world. I don't know how much that features in our kind of Christian mindset. And certainly, I went to church for many years without ever knowing that. I thought Jesus was just a historical figure who came and taught us how to love each other. I didn't realize he was coming again to judge the living and the dead. I ought to have known it because in the creed that a lot of Christians say every Sunday, it says he will come again to judge the living and the dead. You say it every single week. And rightly so, because it says it everywhere in the Bible. So Matthew 25, we've said it together. The day when the Son of Man comes in his glory and separates the sheep from the goats. Or the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts speaks of the day that God has fixed when he'll judge the world in justice by a man he's appointed and has given assurance of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. Or in the book of Hebrews, the writer of the Hebrews says that God will once more shake not just the earth, but also the heavens, the whole shebang. God is going to shake the heavens and the earth. Peter says that God isn't slow in keeping his promise. It's been a long time since God promised the end of the world, but he will come. The day will come, says Peter, like a thief, unexpectedly, in other words. And the heavens will be melted. And John, the apostle, in the book of Revelation says, behold, he's coming with the clouds and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, those who killed him. Everyone says this. Jesus says it. Paul says it, Peter says it, John says it. I mean, this is, you can't be Christian and not believe this, the day of judgment. And Amos warns of it, and it's a day of total destruction. Verse 1, again, I will shake the altar. It starts in the cathedral, in the fake temple. Those who are left, I'll kill with the sword. None of them will flee. None of them will escape. And then point 2, I think this is the point of verses 2 to 4. There's nowhere that you can hide on that day. You won't dodge it on this day. And it's a whole series of places people might try to hide. So if they dig into Sheol, Sheol is basically the grave or the underworld. So imagine you were to dig like really, really deep. You can escape nuclear holocaust by doing that. You can, if you get a bunker far enough underground, you can survive the blast and you can dodge the fallout. And you have a water supply that lasts for 5 years or something. You wait for enough of the half-life of the radiation. Yeah, you can survive a nuclear thing that way. You can't survive God's judgment that way by digging really far down. If they climb up to heaven, that's another way you can, interestingly, you can survive nuclear stuff. Did you know that the, I read this in the papers the other day, the US president has a control center aeroplane. And basically, apparently, if you're high enough, then, you know, the nuclear blast happens down on Earth and you dodge it, and then you can constantly refuel it. So you can keep in the air for days and days and days while the rest of the world just, you know, blows up. So then they have one of those. But those won't help you on the day of God's judgment. If they hide themselves on the top of Carmel, from there, I will search them out and take them. If they hide from my sight at the bottom of the sea, you know, we do not even know what's at the bottom of the sea, do we? We send those little submarines down pretty far and you get the amazing creatures on the David Attenborough thing. But you can't get down to the bottom, but God can get to the bottom and you won't escape there. If they go into captivity before their enemies, verse 4, there I will command the sword and it shall kill them. I will fix my eyes upon them for evil. That is for harm and not for good. You cannot escape. This motif comes a couple of other places in the Bible. It made me think of Obadiah. And Obadiah is about Edom. Edom has this city fortress. One of the fun bits of archaeology, if you go to the Middle East, is looking at what the ancient peoples considered impregnable fortresses. And often they were on the top of mountains. I mean, it's the ultimate sort of James Bond villain headquarters. And, it worked pretty well, because if you were an army approaching on a plain and then someone found this rocky outcrop and put a fortress on the top of it, you were pretty safe. I mean, you just need a few archers and you can pick people off even as they approach from miles away. So impregnable fortresses, they do pretty well. And Edom was an impregnable fortress. And Obadiah writes, the pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. It's that illusion, isn't it, of the most powerful people who think I am beyond reach. You know, I don't know how deep is the bunker underneath the Kremlin. I don't know. But they probably feel pretty safe there. And God says, you're not safe. No one can hide on this day. The other passage, maybe you're thinking of this, the other passage it reminded me of was Psalm 139, which is a really beautiful psalm, saying that God's with us everywhere. It's very comforting. You know, wherever you are, God is with you. Psalm 139. This is like that, but the same truth, but the more sobering side of it. He's with you to comfort you wherever you are, Christian. He's after you to get you wherever you are, enemy. There's no way you can hide. And the reason for that is because God's the creator. I mean, he doesn't just run the UK, or let's think of an actually powerful country. He doesn't just run China or Russia or the United States. You know, he hasn't just got ordinary military power that can get to some places on the planet. He made the planet. So where would you go that he couldn't reach you? And we've had it actually three times in Amos. I put them in the table. That this like warning that God is not just the God of Judah, you know, where Amos is from. He's not just, this isn't just a particular Christian version of the end. No, God's the one who runs the world because he made it. There is a thing in there in our current age, I guess it was true in Amos's day as well, of this kind of relativism in religion. And social anthropologists are all into it. You know, if you're Israelite, you'll worship the God of Israel. But it might be you're from Moab, and so you'll worship your Moabite gods. And, you know, maybe you're from the UK, or you might be Christian then if you're from the UK, because lots of Christian schools there. Or maybe you're from India, in which case you'll be a Hindu, won't you? Or from China, and maybe you're Confucian. And it's all just, you know, different gods for different peoples, and that's how it is. You know, this is just the particular Israel God version of the end, we think. No, says Amos, because the God on whose behalf I'm speaking made and runs the world. So this is the true reality for everybody. He started the world, he'll end the world. And Amos reminds us of this, the Lord, the God of hosts, verse 5, who touches the earth and it melts. All who dwell on it mourn. All of it rises like the Nile and sinks again like the Nile. I think this is the point that the Nile is very tidal, so it goes up really high and goes down really low. And especially if there's an earthquake, you get sort of equivalent of a tsunami in the Nile. It goes up really high and really low. It's like the whole earth is moving. Well, God does that. He builds his upper chambers in the heavens. He founds his vault on the earth. He calls to the waters of the sea and pours them out on the surface of the earth. The Lord is his name. He is in charge of all the water in the world. Chapter 4, he forms the mountains. He creates the wind. He makes the morning darkness. He treads on the heights of the earth. The Lord, the God of hosts, is his name. In Amos chapter 5, he made the Pleiades and Orion. These are the constellations of stars. So he made the sea. He made the mountains. He made the wind. He made the waters. He made the heavens. He made the universe. And so you're not going to escape from him. You know, this isn't just the particular niche Israelite prophet or Judea prophet view of the end of the world. It's not just the particular Grace Church Greenwich sermon because they're a bit fanatical end of the world. This is the creator announcing it. And by the way, he's got it right before. Amos predicted the end of Israel and it's gone to the Assyrians. 722 BC, and a civilization wiped out. Jesus predicted the end of Jerusalem, and it was gone AD 70, wiped out for 300 years. And there's a place called Jerusalem now, but it's a rebuild hundreds of years later. The original Jerusalem completely destroyed. Jesus called it, he got it right. Amos called it, he got it right. And now they're warning of the final day of the Lord. And it's real. And it is, final point, a day of separation. James illustrated it brilliantly. I love the illustrations that are just the Bible's illustration. So the kids' talk this week was actually written by Amos, and then James just plagiarized it, saying, well done. Verse 9, behold, I'll command and shake the house of Israel. There's another earthquake symbolism. I'll shake the house of Israel among the nations as one shakes with a sieve. And no pebble shall fall to the earth. I'll tell you, I had a lot of trouble with this verse because there are two ways that it could go, and translators differ. And James and I were puzzling about it for most of Thursday, actually. So is it that you shake the sieve and the bad stuff gets left behind, like the pebbles that you throw away? Or is it that you shake with the sieve and the good stuff gets left behind? And to try and get the two inches in your mind, think, is this sieving out pebbles or is this straining rice? Because when you strain rice, you sieve it and you keep the stuff in the colander and or vegetables, or whatever, and you throw away the water or the gunge, right? So which way round is it? Well, it's pretty obvious because it's got pebbles in it. So, you know, I don't think they strain rice in colanders in the ancient world, but they do sift out pebbles. So that it's pretty obvious which way round it is, except that. Well, they're holding the sieve over. Where is your sieve, James? Such a good illustration. Just get out what's in it. So you think, you know, the stuff you want to keep is the stuff that goes through, except that Amos says, I'll sieve it among the nations. Do you want to be scattered over the nations? You know, like thrown into exile, you can go to Egypt, you can go to Assyria, you can go off to another, to Moab, going off to different enemy nations. And the pebbles are the ones that don't fall. In general in the Bible, falling to the ground is a bad thing. None of the pebbles will fall to the ground. It could be either. I'm not really sure. I think probably all the commentaries think the good stuff goes through and the pebbles, you know, the bad stuff gets stuck, which is how James taught it. I think that's probably right. But I'm not totally sure. The point is, sieves, they separate stuff. That's the clear thing. Some of it's left and some of it goes through. That's the point. And Amos is either telling you no one's going to escape, not one pebble is going to survive. Every pebble will be collected and thrown away. Or he's telling you not one of God's true people will be lost. Even though judgment's coming, God's going to preserve his remnant. And actually, both are true. I'm not quite sure which one is the image of the sieve, but both are true. There is a day of separation. Some go through and some don't. God is going to come in judgment. There's nowhere you can hide except, he says, verse 8, I won't utterly destroy the house of Jacob. There is a day of separation. There is a way to be safe. There's a way even to be safe on the day of judgment, which is to turn to him. As Amos told us earlier in the book, seek me and live. Seek the Lord that you may live. There's a way to be safe if we trust in the Lord Jesus from the judgment day. And actually, maybe you think this is a very negative sort of message. Not really, it is partly. But you know, none of the other end of the world scenarios has any kind of hope. I mean, it would be nice not to be blown up by nuclear missiles, sure, but what are you going to do about it? I mean, you can't tell everyone to disarm. Maybe global warming is going to melt. Maybe it's too late. What are you going to do about it? You can't suddenly create extra energy than the stuff we've got. Or there could be a pandemic and it's not in your control, and what are you going to do about it? Or, you know, the physicist ones are always the worst, aren't they? What are you going to do about the heat death of the universe? Or the brightening of the sun that vaporizes the oceans? I mean, there's nothing you can do about this. But the true meaning of the end of the world is that Jesus comes and separates people. And there is something you can do about it. If we turn to him, we trust in him, we'll be safe. On the day of sieving, on the day when the shepherd separates the sheep and the goats, you can be safe. I'm going to leave a pause and then we're going to pray together.